welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
On the program today, a very dense and well-informed discussion regarding the facts and trends for the high healthcare costs we have here in Alaska. This event features original findings from financial analyst Mark Foster, commentary on those findings from Assistant Professor of Economics Musin Gutabi, followed by questions from the audience. This event was hosted by Alaska Common Ground on November 15th at 49th State Brewing Company. This is an edited version of the event. In order to hear the full audio, you can visit akcommonground.org.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to present today. I'm going to look at the primary drivers of high healthcare costs in Alaska, and particularly going to drill down and look at medical care costs, because I think that's where a lot of the challenge comes from in our costs in Alaska. So, first thing I'm going to look at is what's the magnitude of the challenge that we face in those costs compared to other states, other Western states, and put us in the context of international comparisons so we can look at U.S. international and Alaska in international comparisons. Drill down into the primary cost drivers, looking at both how much people are paying, whether they're Medicaid, Medicare, or commercial, and who's providing the service? Hospitals, nursing homes, physicians and clinical services, pharmaceuticals, et cetera. And take a look at the public data that we have from 2009 through 2014. Then extend that from 14 to 15 and 16 using some private data that we can make public, looking at claims for the state of Alaska and looking at price and volume variance. And then step back and look at some national studies of where the excess costs are in our healthcare system and compare that to the Alaska system and draw some conclusions about what might be amenable to change and looking on the horizon what some of the challenges are. Let's get into the comparisons. If you look at the raw data, you'll find Alaska sits pretty high up on expenditures per capita, right below the District of Columbia in 2014. But the interesting thing for us to note is our compound annual growth rate in expenditures continues to be well above most of the other states. And remember, we haven't adjusted yet. This is the raw data. We haven't looked at cost of living or demographics. When we make those adjustments, because as people age, their healthcare expenditures become more expensive, and the difference between men and women begin to converge as you get out in those older groups. So we want to make that adjustment to take that out of the equation when we're looking at state-to-state comparisons. International comparisons, this is life expectancy and cost per capita for spending adjusted for the cost of living. And you look at the countries, they do tend to follow along a curve with more expenditures being associated with longer life expectancy, with a notable outlier, the U.S. We spend a lot, but we don't get near the same return in terms of life expectancy. And if you pull the U.S. out of the regression and just look at those countries where they really do have national systems, you'll see the regressions get pretty tight. They get up to about 0.6 just on that simple variable. So the U.S. tends to have a gap. We spend above the regression line easily at $7,000 per capita more, and we're behind 4 to 5 years less. So we have a big challenge in the U.S., and Alaska in particular, and North Dakota are further behind. Now when I combine the Alaska and the international comparisons and look at the dollars of healthcare expenditures after I adjust for the cost of living for the incremental life years that people gain from those investments, Alaska spends about $5,600 for each life year gained in life expectancy. Iceland only spends $300 to get that same increase in life expectancy. Step back for a moment and ask ourselves, what are the primary drivers of health outcomes? What really causes sort of people to live longer and live healthier lives? Behaviors and genetics and social circumstances dominate that relative contribution to health. And education and income are a very significant piece of this. Medical care tends to only contribute about 10% when I'm looking at US data. Other systems, medical care tends to be much better correlated with outcomes. Within medical care, the other thing to keep in mind is there's access to care and there's access to health insurance. When I look at the entire US pool, access to care tends to be more valuable than access to health insurance. If you drill down and look at subpopulations within the US, you'll see that access to care and health insurance become very valuable, particularly for at-risk populations. The recent research around the Medicaid expansion shows a very high level of return on those investments compared to some of the initial results. And particularly when they're looking across the expansions that have been going on for a while, that's where they're starting to see robust data on 5 to 10 year horizons where you're getting good returns when you're addressing the investment to the at-risk populations. Why do we care about high cost of medical care? Why do we care? Why is that important? Maybe that's a choice we're making, and that's a reasonable investment and the return sufficient. If you look at the national literature, particularly from the National Academy, in a report that looked at better care at lower cost from 2013, they made some very interesting observations based on their assessment of how much cost is wasted in the US healthcare system. The unnecessary healthcare costs and waste exceed the budget for the Department of Defense in the United States by more than $100 billion. Healthcare waste is about 1.5 times the total infrastructure investment, public and private, in the United States in any given year. The unnecessary costs and waste in that report indicated that if you directed it to insurance coverage, you would have enough to cover the entire population of people who are employed and their beneficiaries, both the employer and the employee contributions. So there's some folks who believe there's a lot of resource that can be redirected. If we accept their analysis and apply it to Alaska, it roughly comes out to about $3.3 billion of excess costs in Alaska, where we've got roughly $10 billion. You could redirect that to a wage increase and get 18 to 20% wage increase in the state. Or you can redirect it to the permanent fund dividend, and that would grow to about $5,360. So it gives you a sense of the order of magnitude of the potential waste that's been identified in some of the national studies. What are the primary drivers of the high cost growth in Alaska? Well, before we dive into that, we want to look at the US and understand the context and what the long-term drivers are. Technology has been identified as the primary driver of cost over the long term, 1960s through the 2007 period. Incomes next, a little over a quarter. Insurance coverage, maybe about 10, 11%. Demographics make a contribution, and medical price inflation is also in there. So when we think about those cost drivers and apply that to the Alaska market, one of the questions that we have is, all right, what factors might be significantly different here compared to the rest of the country? Not in necessarily this historic period, but a more current period. I would argue that in the 2009 to 2014 period that we're looking at the data, there's not a significant difference in technology. Alaska's income has fallen behind the income growth of other places. Insurance coverage here is holding about the same level of cost sharing that's happening in other places, which is to say businesses are pushing more costs to employees. Demographics here, we have a slightly increased, faster sort of aging out of the population, so that's going to give us a little more cost. And finally, medical price inflation, as it turns out, is a very big factor here compared to other places. And we're going to drill down and look at that in a minute. We'll start with Medicare spending to give you a sense of where Alaska is. If I look at how fast Medicare spending per enrollee was growing from 2009 to 2014, and compare the spending per enrollee so we can look at cost and cost growth, Alaska is about average but below the spending per enrollee. And that's pretty typical of the pattern that we've seen in Medicare. And a good portion of that is due to the relatively younger population in the Medicare pool that we have here in state. Medicaid, on the other hand, Alaska is in the high cost and in the high cost growth quadrant. And North Dakota is racing ahead over this period of time as well. So there's some challenges there as we look at the data in Alaska compared to other places. Finally, on commercial, for the 09 to 14, Alaska sits at the US average for cost growth, but still well above the average for per enrollee. When I pull apart private insurance spending per enrollee and look at Western states, which tend to have a similar utilization pattern, we tend to use less in the Western states compared to the South and the East. So across those states, Alaska's cost and cost growth is in the leadership pack among the growth and certainly in the cost per enrollee. Now let's look at hospital and nursing home, physician and clinical services, and particularly pharmaceuticals, and ask ourselves, what are the drivers of costs in the Alaska market compared to the other states? Well, as it turns out, if I look at the Alaska cost compared to the other states, the ratio for hospital and nursing homes about 1.3. Physicians and clinical services about 1.96, approaching 2. So it's a pretty expensive comparison when I look at physicians and clinical services compared to hospitals. Pharmaceuticals, interestingly enough, remain well below the other states. And even after I age adjust, we tend to be below the other states in pharmaceuticals. If I look carefully at the growth over this period, 09 to 14, we find that the hospital and nursing home growth is lower than the physician and clinical services growth in Alaska. Physician and clinical is about 6.2 per year, hospital is about 4.1. Compared to the other states, you'll see that we're slightly ahead of the hospital cost growth in other states and way ahead of the physician and clinical services. And so that's the challenge that we've been having here in recent history, is very rapid growth in physician and clinical services prices. When I look at utilization, for the most part, our utilization remains behind the comparison states, and a few places it's beginning to catch up. And those places tend to be in outpatient surgical centers, where we're seeing a little bit of growth there in utilization. When I look at the price that's paid for commercial private insurance payers to physician groups, particularly primary care, gastroent, cardiology, and orthopedics, what we see over time from 2009 to 2014 is rapid growth in Alaska and a big gap between Alaska and the next sort of expensive states. I've used Wyoming here as a benchmark. So what we find is the price in 2014 for like cardiology was approaching 5 times Medicare and orthopedics 5.5 times. When I bring that data forward, because that's the best I have for all the commercial claims, I want to bring that data forward from 14, 15, and 16 using the state of Alaska's prices that they're paying in their claims data. And we look at the cost differentials by in pharmaceutical, takes a ramp up over that time period, ambulatory visits, inpatient days, medical service. So you can see lots of cost growth. And interestingly, it's not utilization. The green is the utilization. It's still prices growing at a rapid rate, 14, 15, and 16. There is some indication in the market that there's some price moderation occurring in 2017, but that's early in the data, so I don't have a full set to show you there. The other thing to note is as those prices go up, they appear to have attracted additional specialists. When I look at the number of specialists per 100,000 population, those prices have been attracting additional players to the market. Our primary care has been relatively flat compared to the western states, which have been growing, but our specialists have been growing faster than our other western states. So it looks like the price has been sufficient, those high prices have been sufficient to attract supply.
This is FM 91.1. You are hearing from financial analyst Mark Foster. He is providing commentary on his findings regarding the facts and trends contributing to Alaska's high healthcare costs. We return now to his presentation.
Let's go ahead and take a look at this. Where are the excess costs in the U.S. healthcare system? The usual suspects are unnecessary services, roughly 8 to 9%, inefficiently delivered services, about 5%, excess administrative costs, maybe 8%, prices that are too high in the lower 48, about 4%, and missed prevention opportunities at about 2%. Fraud comes in at about 3%. So when they total it up, Dartmouth Health Atlas and other folks who've looked at it get to about 30 to 35% of the health care is not productively deployed of our expenditures in the U.S. When I apply that to Alaska, I would say our utilization tends to be below those norms, and so we're actually not over-utilizing in many areas. But in terms of inefficiencies, excessive administrative costs, and prices that are too high, and missed prevention opportunities, I think we are behind the rest of the country, and so our excess costs in those areas is actually greater. When you apply that to Alaska, somewhere around $3.3 billion in excess costs. If you look at the more seasoned veterans of the healthcare wars who've been at it for several decades, and you look at their writing in the last 12 months, I tried to grab someone who's, I think, represents what I'll call the emerging blowback in response to high prices in the U.S., variable quality, and challenges to access to care. And I would say Jeffrey Sachs is one potential one to look at. And he's got a list of things that he would recommend people think about in order to stop the high price growth, improve access to care, and try and improve the overall quality of care that's available. And he goes to move to capitation for Medicare, Medicaid, and tax-exempt private health insurance plans. He's also suggested we need to limit compensation of the CEOs and top managers because that appears to be growing rapidly. He believes that we should require Medicare and other public providers to negotiate drug prices. We need to set maximum prices on drugs for public health emergencies. radically simplify regulatory procedures, facilitate tax shifting from doctors to other providers, because there's a challenge there, cap the amount of deductibles and cost sharing by households so they don't have to just get cost sharing and wind up picking it all up. We've got to cap that amount to some reasonable amount. Use the savings that we achieved to actually improve community health and home health, where he believes there's a significant amount of opportunity in the U.S., particularly with respect to obesity, opioids, mental illness. Advertising and other marketing by pharmaceuticals, and in his mind, the fast food industry has not helped our health outlook. And finally, he believes it's timely to offer a public plan to compete with the private plans. Medicare for All is one of those potential solutions that he's offered up. There are others. With that, let me take a break and let others.
So I'm now going to turn to Mohsin Ghatabi and ask him a couple of questions to get him started. So Mohsin, I'll start with the first question is, what do you think the most interesting things that Mark Foster has said tonight?
Okay, let's start with the easy one. Difficult to pick something specific. I think that the stickiness of this differential in my mind is the most important element of this conversation. What I mean by stickiness is that these price differentials have existed for a long time, so there are baseline differences, and then the fact that the growth rate in Alaska expenditures or costs exceeds that of Western state, irrespective of how you define a comparison group, you still find that Alaska is growing faster. So we have this Alaska premium, if you will, and then every year our costs keep going up at a faster rate, which means that we're diverging further and further away from these comparison states. And so I think that that's, in my mind, every time I give one of these talks or I think about this question, that's where I think the conversation should start, because I think that everybody in this room would agree, yes, Alaska healthcare costs are high. Yes, they affect the public sector, the private sector, and individuals, right? And so I do economic forecasts. I walk into a room and I say, oh, the healthcare sector is the only bright industry in the economy. And then I walk into the next and I go, oh my God, the healthcare costs are killing Alaska. So I think that it's really important to kind of just start thinking about how can we do a decomposition of the relative importance of some of these different factors that Mark has cited in a way that quantifies for us, in a way that's simple, how much is, for example, competition responsible for the price differential, how much is rurality responsible for the differential? How much is it the demographics? And then, if there is a way to do that, that's informative, because that's the analysis I've been hungry for, to be honest with you. If we do that, then I think the next natural question is, which of these elements are policy sensitive? Meaning, where can we actually make a dent, right? We have certain levers that we can pull. Can we pull a lever that actually makes a difference in a way that gets us back to some of these levels that are realistic? Because we're never gonna drop our prices to become one of the lowest cost states, but we can potentially revert back to growth rates that are similar in the rest of the country. So.
Well, thank you, Mohsin. So I have another question, which a little different view of this. What is the most important thing that Mark said that you don't think, based on your experience, what's the most important thing that Mark said that most Alaskans don't understand?
I think that something, so a little more than 50% of Alaskans get insurance through an employer, which means that while we're aware of the cost differential, I don't think people think as much about the effect that medical costs have had on wage stagnation. And I really think that that's a dimension that could potentially get people behind the cause of curbing healthcare costs, right? And so if you think that the increases in costs are actually taking away raises, which essentially is what they're doing, then I think that that you start framing the question a little bit differently. Because right now, it's easy to think that if I am getting insurance from an employer and I'm paying my contribution, which is on average in Alaska about 13% or so of the overall cost, I'm not actually feeling that much of a dent. But if you think about it as every year Alaska healthcare costs go up, I'm not getting wage increases that could be going into my pocket, then I think that that changes the conversation a little bit and makes it a bit more real. So.
Okay. I met last night with some entrepreneurs, and one of them said, "Hey, Cliff, everybody knows healthcare costs are terribly high in Alaska." And I said, "I don't think everybody completely understands that, in part because they're shielded. A substantial number of Alaskans are shielded from that reality through substantial insurance coverage." But like I said, if entrepreneurs who are, by definition, trying to start their own businesses don't have big companies or organizations or institutions behind them, are obviously way more aware of that.
Sure. No, I think that's fair. I mean, like I said, the reality is that the vast majority of Americans, including Alaskans, get insurance through an employer, which means that your actual out-of-pocket contribution to some of these numbers that Mark was showing, is, while substantial, is still only, you know, a very small portion of the actual overall burden. But clearly there are very real costs in terms of foregone wages, in terms of competitiveness on whether or not a business ends up locating in the state and whether or not the state can balance its budget. And so there are far-ranging consequences.
Right. And as you said, to make sure people understand, even if you have great insurance, which, full disclosure, I've had most of my adult life through an employer or post-employment, your wages or compensation may have been held back, or as you said, stagnated because of the very high medical costs here in Alaska.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, okay. I think that there is evidence to support that both nationally and at the state level. And the reality is, I mean, I think that the easiest way to think about it is that the employer thinks about overall compensation, which is comprised of the wage that the individual makes plus whatever benefits, and the biggest portion of the benefits are the healthcare costs, right? And so if you think about it as a zero sum, the more he or she is contributing to your benefits, the less he's gonna be able to give you an actual take-home wage, so.
Okay, what other thoughts or comments do you have to make about what Mark has said tonight?
No, I think it's a conversation starter. I think that, as I said at the beginning, I'm hungry for us to get to a quantification off the relative importance of some of these factors, right? And so, because I think that, unfortunately, in many of these conversations, we've stopped essentially at the point where we've identified things that we believe are leading contributors, and then we want to jump to solutions. And the economist in me, the researcher in me, wants to say, let's call time out and figure out what matters here, how are we different in a way that allows us to actually build solutions that are sustainable, that make sense for the state. And so, and whenever I see these presentations, I'm reminded of that, because it's thorough, it's complete, but it's a decomposition that basically assumes that, you know, for example, demographics are not relevant, and that we're gonna reach some sort of solution or some sort of conclusion that's gonna draw us into a corner and force us to basically pick a solution without unpeeling the onion and truly understanding, you know, like I said, how much of the 20% differential is due to each of the factors? How much of it is due to shortages? How much of it is due to competition? How much of it is due to rurality? How much of it is due to scale, right? And so, and then start thinking about what are the barriers to entry? What are the things that we can actually do? So yeah.
First of all, I want to make sure a word you keep using is rurality, which is the nature of how rural we are, and not morality. Is that correct?
Yeah, I am not making any judgments about anybody's morality except my own.
Rurality is a less commonly used word, so I want to make sure I got it right.
I am talking about the rural population and how big Alaska is and how challenging it is to provide healthcare in Alaska.
Okay, and although, of course, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of villages off the road system here in Alaska, the very substantial majority of the population lives on the road system, of course. Right.
Fair enough.
Right. Mark, have you recovered enough to comment on what you've learned from listening to Musin's comments?
No, I always appreciate Musin's insight and his encouragement to go further into the data. And I think there's a lot to be had by diving a little bit further in. I would comment on some of the additional work that I've done that's not included here. Really does try to unpack rural Alaska as a separate and distinct market from Fairbanks, Matsu, Anchorage, Kenai Peninsula, that rail belt. And what I find is the high prices are indeed in the rail belt and in Anchorage for physician services and outpatient surgery centers. There are some high-priced hospitals and facilities in that rail belt as well. And so if you look carefully, you'll see it's not a rural problem that we have when we look at the aggregate data and we decompose it. It's a statewide problem.
This is 91.1 FM KSKA Anchorage, and you are listening to Addressing Alaskans. We've been hearing a well-informed discussion regarding the facts and trends for the high healthcare costs we have here in Alaska. We now go back to Cliff Groh, chair of Alaska Common Ground, who is the moderator for the program today, featuring financial analyst Mark Foster and assistant professor of economics Musin Gutadi.
Wow. So in addition, is it also accurate to say, Mark, that the urban hospitals, particularly hospitals in Anchorage, have a margin, sometimes called operating surplus or profit margin? This is ordered three times the national average?
I think you'll find there's a Milliman report, a PDF circulating, that has data to that effect. I think that's correct.
Okay. Mark, could you give a short description of what you perceive as the main causes of the higher the national average and substantially higher healthcare costs here in Alaska?
Let me limit it by saying that I'm specifically focused on the what I'll call the high price growth factors that I see. I'm not looking at the relatively high prices. I'm looking at the rapid growth. And when I look at that in particular, I believe one of the big causes that's driving that are relatively concentrated group practices in specialties relative to the buyers of those services, not insurance per se, but the employers are relatively fragmented market, and they're not able to leverage as much from the insurance and in turn the medical providers. Having said that, I believe there's evidence from 2017 that is beginning to change in the market. And in essence, the prices have gotten high enough and the supply of specialists has gotten large enough that the insurance and buy-side employers are now beginning to see some relief from those price trends. But that's just within the last sort of cycle of negotiation, if you will. And so if I look back over the last 10 years or the last 5 years, it really is a very rapid escalation in prices that we're still laboring under.
Is the short, punchy way of saying this is that perhaps the cost curve is bending down, Mark?
I believe that there are some prices that are beginning to moderate. And I think if we look at facilities fees, both outpatient and inpatient, I don't see much moderation there. I only see the moderation within some specialty practices. So that's what I'm seeing right now.
Musin, what comment do you have on Mark's comments about?
I just want to ask him a question. Do you think that the recession has anything to do with that?
I think the recession has reduced the overall volume of business that the providers are seeing. And that in combination with that, I think the negotiators have been essentially holding back capacity as much as they can in the negotiation to try and get some relief on prices. And the combination of those factors, I think, is being helpful in reducing price growth.
Is it something that's sustainable, or is it a blip on the radar?
I believe, given, let's sort of set aside the recession for a minute, I think independent of that, the prices are sufficiently high and the rate of growth in providers and capacity is sufficiently high that we can see some moderation without impacting our access to care. So I think there will be more aggressive negotiation from employers to get better results once they're, I think, get comfortable that they're not going to have a negative impact on their employees' ability to access the care. I think GCI is a great example, using Bridge Health to fly people out, and it's really learning a lot about how can they get better sort of pricing and value from the services they get for their healthcare dollars.
Do you not think that for that medical tourism to start having a dent, the volume of it would have to be fairly significant, right? For it to give employers leverage.
I would have thought that up until looking at data from 2017, where there's not necessarily a significant increase in medical tourism, but it's just enough in combination with the other factors that it's starting to get the attention of the folks who've been setting prices, who are now starting to back off of their rate of growth.
But I mean, you seem comfortable in saying that economic conditions are not necessarily the drivers of this moderation, because I mean, during
I think they're a contributor.
No, because I mean, during
not necessarily the only driver that we're seeing having an impact.
During the Great Recession, there was much writing on the fact that the national healthcare cost curve, you know, was slowing down, and it turned out to be largely driven by, you know, slower utilization and, you know, just a small temporary decrease in costs. So, I mean.
Right. And I certainly think that wave function is certainly at play here in Alaska, but I think there are other sort of waves in there that I think are contributing.
Fair enough.
Okay. So we're going to start with some questions from the audience, of which I have a number, and good on you. An active, engaged audience. Okay. So we're going to start out with a simple question. What about the quality of care in the United States versus other countries and the fact that on average U.S. citizens are unhealthier, less healthy, because Americans are not as physically active as Europeans? How does this compare in terms of the Alaska context? Alaska per capita has unhealthier people and a high Medicaid population. Mark, would you like to start with that, in terms of what you think about the quality of care and in terms of the unhealthy population that is perceived to be in Alaska?
Well, if I look at the total Alaska population, I find a bimodal distribution. I've got a bunch of folks who are not healthy, and I have a bunch of folks who are healthier than average. And so there really is what I'll call sort of a Colorado subpopulation, healthy, outdoors, active, within the state, and then there's a less healthy population within the state that's particularly inactive, in part because of the long winters. And it really is the interplay in terms of how fast those grow and sort of change out. So I don't think it's accurate to try and characterize the median when there really isn't too many in the middle. It really is sort of bimodal. I have two things going on. So I think of it as a population that's relatively healthy and a population that has higher than average challenges that looks like an at-risk population when I look at the Alaska compared to other states. So I think that's the way I think about
it. Okay, and now I want to go from the man who almost always bicycles and takes a bus all around Anchorage to the man who had the dreams or illusions of being a professional tennis player at one point. Mohsin?
Illusions, please. Let's set the record straight.
Okay. Mohsin, what thoughts do you have about Alaska as a relatively unhealthy population versus Americans, particularly Europeans?
First, I'm going to change illusions to delusions. Okay. And then, of course, lifestyle choices. I think Mark showed the slide earlier. Behavior is largely responsible for healthcare costs, and obviously, when Mark earlier was showing the life expectancy numbers, that's where things start to get a bit complicated. We're not getting as much of a bang for our buck from healthcare spending, partially because lifestyle choices are different in the US. I don't know that our demographics or our unhealthiness in terms of, for example, obesity rates are terribly different from the rest of the country. So I don't think that that's responsible for these differences. So, you know, where do we devote resources, I think, is part of this question, right? And so is it preventive care? Is it in education? Is it in, you know, or is it in fixing the market, right? And so, because every conversation that we have essentially picks whether or not we accept that lifestyle choices are set, and therefore the only margin that we can potentially alter is that of market concentration, or can we set prices, or can we set compensation at a certain level. The other dimension in which we can potentially make a dent is in influencing lifestyle choices, and there are hundreds of experiments all around the world on how to nudge people to save more money or eat healthier or exercise more. So, and I think the most recent Nobel Prize winner is a behavioral economist who's made a living on nudges. And so maybe that's, you know, where we should be devoting at least part of our resources.
Thanks. We're going to go to another question from somebody who knows a lot about healthcare economics. And this is starts out with some facts. 10 to 15% of the patients or of the population use 65% to 75% of the healthcare dollar. And high utilizers are consuming a large percentage of the costs, and the cost increases. And Mark, would you comment on that? Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, the number I have in my head, sort of 5% drive 55% of the cost. So somewhere like that is the ratio. As it turns out, that number is pretty stable over time. I went back and looked at data from 1950, 1960, 70, 80, coming forward, and that proportion is about the same. So I don't know that it's the people who get sick in any given year or have high health care that's really driving our challenge, because that proportion is relatively stable. I think it's the underlying drivers that we have, or technology that we were looking at. Income, as we get rich, we do demand more health care, and as our incomes moderate, we're moderating our demand, but some of the folks on the other side who are pricing it may not be moderating it as fast as our incomes. And so I think those are some of the interactions. Yes, there is, I think, getting back to the 550 problem, I do think there are high utilizers and chronic care areas where we can make a significant difference and reduce those costs, but that's not the only place I would go.
Okay, Maxine, do you have any thoughts on this topic of super utilizers, sometimes called?
It's a similar pattern across the country. In small share of individuals responsible for a large portion of the costs. I think that the question that matters is there a way to identify those people early on and potentially curb some of those costs in the long run, right? Because if they're chronic conditions, then you're basically bearing that cost for 30, 40 years, however long they're part of the system. And if not, then again, then you have to start shifting your attention towards something else, right? And so, because if they're conditions that are not preventable or they're not easy to predict, then the fact that we know that does not necessarily lend itself to finding a solution.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. You are listening to a presentation regarding facts and trends in Alaska's high healthcare costs, featuring financial analyst Mark Foster and assistant professor of economics Musin Gutabi. We go back to the program as they are answering questions from the audience.
So, some people have talked about an Alaska healthcare authority, and in your answer, you'll need to explain what that would be. But this person says, would an Alaska healthcare authority promote and endorse competitive bidding among all providers, or would it only be on selected providers at the exclusion of other providers? Mark, do you want to take a shot at that?
I think the short answer is we don't know how the authority will approach its sort of bidding process. I think that will largely be a factor of who sits on their governing board, and to the extent that that's just buy side or whether it's a board that consists of more than that. Because I think one of the considerations that's been raised is if we're too aggressive and narrow the network, will we create a circumstance where we don't have adequate supply? And I think that's a consideration you want to be mindful of.
Okay, and I'm going to ask another question to make that previous question more understandable. Is an Alaska Healthcare Authority the concept of having the people who are the institutions that pay for medical care in Alaska somehow bind together and pool their bargaining power in bargaining with providers of healthcare services such as physicians and hospitals? Would that be a short description?
Yeah, I think the underlying rationale behind the authority is to consolidate buying power and reduce administrative overhead.
Musin, do you have any thoughts on either of the last two or three questions?
No.
Okay. How can it be explained that most Anchorage physicians, and especially the wealthiest, refuse to see Medicare patients, where all physicians in rural Alaska accept all medical patients and provide excellent care? Notice I didn't write this question. So I'll let you start, Mark.
I would encourage the physicians who are not seeing the Medicare patients to state their case, and I'd welcome the opportunity to interrogate that case.
Okay, Mark. Like I said, we'll see if we can get you back again. Musin, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, our Medicare to Medicaid ratio is the lowest in the country. Reimbursement. So us and Wyoming are the only states that have a Medicare to Medicaid reimbursement ratio that's less than one. That means that for every dollar of Medicaid compensation, if the doctor were to see a Medicare patient, they would get less than that dollar. And so, again, I'm not justifying behavior, but I think that there is evidence that seniors do have difficulty accessing doctors, I think partially because the Medicare to Medicaid ratio is low.
So this another person asks, how do we do when a cancer is diagnosed? Don't we actually exceed the other nations? And this is sort of like the theory that if a cancer is diagnosed, there actually is better results here in the United States healthcare system compared to other countries. Is that accurate?
Among the data that I've reviewed, the U.S. does tend to do better on prostate cancer than the other international comparators, but that's the standout. Most of the other parameters, there isn't a significant cancer sort of benefit because of the cancer care that we provide in the U.S. compared to the other countries. And I'm thinking Japan, Canada, Germany, basically the more developed ones. It really is the prostate cancer where we diagnose earlier and get better results. That's sort of the standout when I look across the cancer field.
That's not true for all the cancers in some data that I've looked at. Is that correct? That's
right. The other cancers, I don't think we have a significant competitive advantage in the U.S.
So this person wants to either brag or confess that they're Canadian. So, all right. So this Canadian asks, what is the number one barrier to national health care in the United States? And this person lists some possible reasons or factors. Insurance company lobbyists, fear of the unknown, fear of taxes, the capitalist society of the United States, or some other factor. Mark?
I think
Mohsen, you said
she listed it all. And so.
I don't know that it's a she, but whatever. It's a Canadian. Mark?
Sorry.
There's a recent study in the National Bureau of Economic Research Working Papers that I thought was particularly revealing. It's not to peer review yet, so it's early stuff. Nonetheless, they took a look at campaign contributions before and after federal legislation. Suffice it to say that it is daunting the amount of money that's spent lobbying in the arena of healthcare, and relative to the other countries, it's astounding. So I do think that the evidence is beginning to accumulate that one of our major challenges is the amount of money that's flowing back through the political system.
Does the data show or suggest that lack of primary care, especially for Medicare and Medicaid, drives up costs? For example, does this shift the burden of care to higher cost specialists who provide fee for service versus better preventative care? So is there a problem of a lack of primary care overall driving up healthcare costs in Alaska?
I see some of that when I look at Medicare provided by primary care and Medicare provided by specialists. So you see a little bit of a price premium occurring there. So there is some of that in the data, yes.
Hussein, do you have a thought?
I'm not going to answer your question, but I'm going to make a comment.
Okay. It's
nice to have a microphone. You can just do that. No, one of the things I've been thinking about quite a bit is we're having a healthcare conversation, but we're in the midst of a recession, and every time I've given a talk over the last 2 years, I've mentioned how the Alaska economy's been lucky because the share of people over the age of 65 has increased so much, and their resources have nothing to do with the health of the economy. And one of the things I think about is if access continues to be a problem, if healthcare costs continue to be a problem, if there are difficulties in meeting the needs of seniors, what are the implications for Alaska going forward on a much broader scale than simply healthcare? And so while that's not exactly what we're talking about, I think it's really important to remind ourselves that this bleeds into other things and that the consequences for potentially not addressing some of these issues have a wide-ranging effect and potentially, I don't want to say catastrophic, but significant challenges for, you know, how many people go out to eat at restaurants or how much money is being spent in the economy.
Okay. In a market as small as Alaska's, will travel benefits for care ultimately be detrimental to Alaska's healthcare system? Mark, you go first, then Musin.
I think there's certainly some risk that travel benefits might be detrimental. I think there's also some opportunity that they create both price and value competition. If I look at the amount of care that's provided in-state to in-state residents in Alaska, it's continually sort of a very high percentage. If I go to Wyoming and look at that data, you'll see that maybe 80-82% of the care for residents is in-state. They are traveling to other places. And I don't think that traveling in Wyoming has significantly reduced the quality of care for the folks in that place. And I do think prices in some respects have moderated as a result of that sort of traveler benefit for the folks of Wyoming.
Machine.
You have to think about it slightly differently. I mean, what's the incentive from an employer not to use travel benefits, right? And so if you think about it from that perspective, they're thinking about their bottom line, and they're going to go seek out procedures that are reasonable in cost. And so to what extent does that end up affecting the supply of doctors? Naturally, if 90% of Alaskans start going elsewhere, the market becomes too small. But it certainly is one way of, if there are these barriers to entry and we're not going to get more doctors here, by expanding the choice set for individuals and for firms, then we're actually competing in a national market, and that puts downward pressure on prices. And so can we think of a scenario where it's potentially bad for the system? Maybe, but you can't fault the individual decision makers who are encouraging employees to do it because it makes sense. I had a student 5 years ago, 4 years ago, that did a paper that was comparing costs of procedures both within the country and outside of the country, and he kept adding things. He would compare just the procedure, and then he would add a 1 week stay in a 5-star hotel, and then he would add the flight, and kept adding all sorts of things, and he would still come up short of what whatever procedure you want cost in Alaska. And so I think that the incentive is for people to exercise that option. And until something changes, I think that that number is going to keep going up.
As one of the shrewdest doctors I've worked with in this project pointed out to me, he said, hey, Cliff, if I was going to go out the out of state to have non-emergency surgery, I would stay wherever I went for a substantial period to make sure that no complications arose, so that I would minimize the risk that I would come back to Alaska, have a complication, and have a surgeon here in Alaska say, sorry, buddy, I can't see you. You know, go back to where you got this particular procedure. An emergency room doctor told me that actually a patient came to see the doctor at the hospital from the airport. The patient had gone outside the state, had a procedure or surgery done, and then apparently, maybe perhaps on the plane coming back to Alaska, caused a problem, and immediately from the airport went to the emergency room. So that is a useful thing to think about when we're contemplating that. This person asks, who decides what some procedure or office visit or something else that a physician or provider provides costs? Are some of these costs so high just because they can be?
Well, certainly there are buyers and sellers, and they agreed on a price. And so that's where the price comes from. And the buyer is typically an insurance company. And then upstream of that is an employer buying either an insurance product or a third-party administrator's pool of providers. And on the sell side, there are hospitals and physicians and pharmaceuticals. So yeah, that's prices are basically determined in that sort of transaction.
Maseen, will you add, subtract, or vary anything that Mark has said?
In specialties, for example, where there are very few providers, I mean, doctors are price setters, right? And so they're not taking the price, they're setting it. And so, and that's where this idea of negotiation goes out the window, right? And so if you don't have options, then you're no longer negotiating. And so with something like the oft-mentioned 80th percentile rule, and again, that's a completely different conversation, it's difficult to know the extent to which the buyer of the service has any ability to actually influence the price that's being set.
Okay. So ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to get you to all give a warm round of applause for our experts tonight.
Mark, it's fucking good to have you.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing about facts and trends contributing to Alaska's high healthcare costs, featuring original findings from financial analyst Mark Foster, commentary on those findings from Assistant Professor of Economics Muhsin Ghitabi, and moderator Cliff Groh. This program was heavily edited from the full two-hour event. If you're interested in hearing the rest of the audio, you can find that at akcommonground.org. I'm your host and producer for Addressing Alaskans, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.